Welcome back, everybody. Sorry, I didn't realize that we were back from breakout rooms. We're going to watch a little video clip now because even though I'm preaching, I thought we would get Andrew Latimer to do part of the sermon for me. And the reason is we're one of those places in the Bible at the moment where, by a coincidence of our planning, well, not really intended by us, but intended by the Lord, something we saw in the book of Revelation and something we see in the book of Mark are going to come right together. And it seemed good to just a little bit of a recap of what we saw in Revelation. So in our series in Revelation, which is, I guess, our main series this year, we're doing 16 weeks in Revelation, just taking a pause at the moment. Evil was a big theme. And Andrew Latimer preached about the reality of evil a few weeks ago. Now we're doing a little mini series on anxiety and fear in Mark's gospel. But in this second installment of this series, evil is a big theme. And I thought it'd just be really useful for us to hear a recap of something we heard in Revelation just before we hear this in Mark. So I said this morning in the physical service, we're now going to watch some telly, but I suppose in a way all of this is telly, but this is some pre-recorded telly, and then we'll be back to the live telly. So here's a clip. Some of you saw this when you were around at the time, but from a service a few weeks ago. Thanks very much.
Everything has to be boiled down to either a social or a psychological explanation. Everything's medicalized. It becomes dysfunction rather than plain wickedness. Probably worth us tackling this whole question, which some of us are asking right now, about Satan. Are we really, as 21st century Londoners, are we expected to believe in a personal devil? Some of us think this is a bit primitive, perhaps a bit naive. Well, there's a book by a secular liberal professor called Andrew Delbanco called The Death of Satan. I haven't read the book, but I've read lots about it and the reviews. And the argument of the book is that Western reductionism just doesn't work. And Delbanco says the problem is illustrated for him in a scene in the film The Silence of the Lambs. And in this scene, the FBI agent approaches this imprisoned madman, Hannibal Lecter, this guy who eats his own victims. And she says to him, "What made you like this? What happened to you?" And he's saying that, look, we in the West, we have this reduced view of reality. Everything has to be boiled down to either a social or a psychological explanation. Everything's medicalized. It becomes dysfunction rather than plain wickedness. And in this scene, Hannibal Lecter looks at the FBI agent and he says, "Nothing has happened to me, Officer Starling. I happened. You can't reduce me to a set of influences. Can't you stand to say I'm evil?" And Delbanco says the modern West cannot answer the monster's question. People used to argue that racism and violence came from a lack of education and privilege. But of course, then we had the Holocaust, which arose out of a culture as educated as any culture on earth. Also in the 20th century, we had Marxism, which argued that our problem is social, or if you could just put the means of production into the hands of the workers, everything will be okay. But of course, when that happened, the workers were every bit as violent and repressive as the capitalists. And the whole system didn't work. So Western reductionism, Delbanco argues, can't account for the depth and the pervasiveness of evil in the human heart. Whereas, of course, the Bible's teaching, which explains that there is real supernatural evil, there is a real devil, there is real evil in the human heart, actually this teaching is far less naive, and it provides a much better explanation for the world we see around us.
Thank you, Andrew. Well, we are going to see real evil in this episode of The Life of Jesus, and it's going to be quite horrifying. And we're in Mark chapter 5. And if you'd like to find it in your Bible, if you have one, if not, it's coming up on the screen. That's Mark 3, I think. Can we have the next slide? Thank you. They came to the other side of the sea, to the country of the Gerasenes. And when Jesus had stepped out of the boat, immediately there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit. He lived among the tombs. and no one could bind him any more, not even with a chain, for he'd often been bound with shackles and chains, but he wrenched the chains apart, and he broke the shackles in pieces. No one had the strength to subdue him. Night and day, among the tombs and on the mountains, he was always crying out and bruising himself with stones. And when he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and fell down before him, and crying out with a loud voice, he said, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I adjure you, by God, do not torment me." For Jesus was saying to him, "Come out of the man, you unclean spirit." And Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" He replied, "My name is Legion, for we are many." And he begged him earnestly not to send them out of the country. Now a great herd of pigs was feeding there on the hillside, and they begged him, saying, "Send us into the pigs, let us enter them." So he gave them permission, and the unclean spirits came out and entered the pigs, and the herd, numbering about 2,000, rushed down a steep bank into the sea and were drowned in the sea. The herdsmen fled and told it in the city and in the country, and people came to see what it was that had happened. And they came to Jesus and saw the demon-possessed man, the one who had had the legion, sitting there, clothed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. And those who'd seen it described to them what had happened to the demon-possessed man and to the pigs, and they began to beg Jesus to depart from their region. As he was getting into the boat, the man who'd been possessed with demons begged that he might be with him. But Jesus did not permit him, but said to him, "Go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you." And he went away and began to proclaim in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him, and everyone marvelled. Well, we've taken as our theme verse today Psalm 23. "Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil." But my question as we begin is, but are you afraid of evil? Because many people are at the moment. In England, in London especially, people are frightened of evil. In fact, women are frightened of evil as they walk home on their own because of the terrible tragedy of what happened to Sarah. And we are conscious not just of our sadness about one woman who met a tragic end, but we're conscious of what that represents about the way men and women treat each other, about the danger we're in, about the horrible things that can happen, about safety and security. And there's been a huge explosion of feeling at the vigil yesterday and on social media now, because we sense that there is a greater evil at work, and people are troubled, people are scared. Maybe you're scared. Many people in London are today. Or maybe you're frightened of supernatural evil, the supernatural powers that lie behind such things. Now, we saw from Andrew's video, many people aren't. In our secular age, people scoff at the idea of a personal devil. And after all, we're just evolved creatures made only of atoms, and there's no supernatural world at all, some people say. But others are much more conscious of the reality of the spiritual world. I remember, I've mentioned before, I think, at Grace Church, in a previous church of mine, one of the elders had been converted out of a spiritualist background. His parents were involved in the occult and in seances and Ouija boards and that kind of thing. And he said he never remembered going to bed as a child without being scared. It wasn't just the irrational fear of monsters under the bed, but it was the real fear of monsters he knew were real, and he'd encountered just the evidence of them. And he said when he first read the Gospels, he didn't read it as I did. I read it as a kind of atheist cynic, and I thought that the exorcisms in the Gospels were a real problem, because I thought, you know, the supernatural doesn't exist, and so the Gospels must be very naive to talk about these things. But he said he read it with a completely different perspective. He knew that the supernatural existed. This had the authentic ring of truth to it. His question wasn't, are there demons, which he knew there were, but is Jesus more powerful than demons? Maybe you also are conscious of the demonic spiritual world. And I ought to say right at the start that to have the evil world manifested in this very open way is unusual. I didn't suggest we ought to find demons around every corner and expect this Mark V situation to be normal as a situation. There are Christian movements that have assumed that this is typical, and there's a whole deliverance ministry mindset, and you know, a pastor needs to know how to do an exorcism because you'll frequently have to do that. And in some cases, in the extreme cases, every time a Christian struggles with a particular sin, you'll say, oh, there must be a demon there to be exorcised. And there's whole books written and sort of exorcism manuals written from here. And they even tell you, you know, how to do it. And if you do it wrong, then the demon might fight back. And so you need to follow the steps Jesus takes. Like, firstly, you ask what the demon's name is, because unless you know its name, you can't have power over it. And yeah, all these sort of things. I think that misses the point. This is not a typical situation. It's mentioned even in the Bible very rarely. So we've actually seen it twice this week, haven't we? Once in our grace groups, if you're a member of the church, on as we looked at the Garden of Eden, where Satan manifests himself as a serpent and speaks directly to Adam and Eve. That's unusual. Or here in Mark, when we meet 2,000 demons. That's rare. Usually, evil is behind the scenes. And we've seen in our studies in the book of Revelation that behind human tyranny, evil can be at work. And behind false teaching and moral compromise in the church, evil can be at work. Do you remember, if you've been following our series in Revelation, how the dragon is in cahoots with the two beasts? So the dragon is Satan, the serpent. But then out of the sea comes a beast who is out to kill Christians, or to persecute Christians. And then along comes the false prophet who's there to seduce Christians. And so actually the devil's work is there all the time. It's behind violence on the streets as a young woman walks home. It's behind political tyranny as Christians are persecuted in some countries. It's behind false teaching in the Church of England as people shift on what the Bible's morality is to fit with modern thinking. It's there everywhere, and very rarely is it here in this form. But it's as Jesus walks the earth that the dark world of evil is stirred up and comes out to meet him in full force. And so everywhere Jesus goes, we discover demonic activity that's absolutely explicit. As I say, not routine in London, I don't think, although the devil is at work in London. But here he's at work in this very real way. And it is a very frightening thing. At least we ought to be frightened if we grasp exactly who our enemy is. And the first point of the sermon, I want to show you just why it is very frightening. Because evil is, we discover here, deadly and untamable. Evil is deadly and untamable. And Mark introduces this theme by telling us emphatically where we found this demon-possessed man. He was, he says, verse 2, out of the tombs, a man with an unclean spirit. Verse 3, he lived among the tombs. Verse 5, night and day among the tombs. He lives in a graveyard. Now, we kind of expect that, don't we? Because in horror movies, everything happens in graveyards. Well, I haven't really watched many of them, but I think in some of them, things happen in graveyards. And it's a kind of standard trope of the horror movie genre. But I wonder whether it comes from here. Because we're discovering when real evil comes out to meet Jesus that evil is associated with death. Evil is bent on destruction. These evil spirits want to kill this man, to destroy this man. And so he lives in the company of those who are already dead, as he himself is half dead. It's a destructive force. And you see that in what happens to the pigs. The demons leave the man and enter this herd of pigs. And what happens to them? They all drown in the sea. And that is what they were trying to do to him, to destroy him. evil associated with death. And we see the same thing in chapter 9. I've put a cross-reference to another passage in Mark's gospel where we encounter evil spirits at work. And it's interesting to me that Mark describes both of these in great detail in chapter 5 and in chapter 9. One of my friends used to say parchment is expensive, by which they mean that when Mark was first writing this, he's only got, you know, a scroll of a certain length that he can afford or he can obtain. He's got to fit in the whole of the life of Jesus. So words matter, and you've got to be you've got to reserve your words where you can. And so last week we looked at the calming of the storm, and it took Mark just 6 verses. You know, that's pretty efficient. 6 verses on the calming of the storm, but 20 verses to tell us about Jesus' release of this man from evil spirits. And then we get another extended discussion of what Jesus did with evil in Mark chapter 9, verses 14 to 29, 15 verses. This time, not a demon-possessed man, but a demon-possessed boy. And it's a really horrific incident. I was conscious as I was reading it this morning in our service that it was, you know, we had lots of children there because the children are sitting with families. And I thought these are pretty scary words, actually. I'm going to read a bit more of it this afternoon. So verse 14, they came to the disciples. They saw a great crowd around them, scribes arguing with them. Immediately all the crowd, when they saw Jesus, were greatly amazed and ran up to him and greeted him. He asked them, "What are you arguing about?" Someone from the crowd answered him, "Teacher, I brought my son to you, for he has a spirit that makes him mute. Whenever it seizes him, it throws him down. He foams and grinds his teeth and becomes rigid." So this boy is having these seizures. "I asked your disciples to cast it out, and they were not able." Jesus answered them, "O faithless generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you? Bring him to me." And they brought the boy to him. And when the spirit saw him, immediately it convulsed the boy, and he fell on the ground and rolled about foaming at the mouth. It must be very distressing to see. But more distressing is this next bit, verse 21. Jesus asked his father, "How long has this been happening to him?" He said, "From childhood, it's often cast him into fire and into water to destroy him." I mean, is that just not horrific? Can you imagine, as a parent, it's your worst nightmare? You go to a bonfire and your son attempts to throw himself into the bonfire so that he will die. You go to the beach and your son attempts to get himself far beyond his depth in the water so that he will drown. I mean, it's a hideous picture that this unclean spirit possessing this boy is trying to kill him, to destroy him. Mark chapter 5 with the man, Mark chapter 9 with the boy, we see that evil is bent on death. And Jesus says the same thing in John's gospel when he describes Satan as a murderer from the beginning. The one who tempted Eve to take the fruit of the tree, that if you eat of it, you will die. He's described in Hebrews as the one with the power over death, that is the devil. Evil is deadly. The devil wants to kill people, and that is frightening. But it's even more frightening when we realize that no one had the strength to subdue this man. Not only is it deadly, but it's untamable. It's beyond human power to control this. And Mark really emphasizes this in chapter 5, verse 3. He lived among the tombs. No one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain. He'd often been bound with shackles and chains, but he wrenched the chains apart and he broke the shackles in pieces. No one had the strength to subdue him. So this just tells us this is not a sort of misdiagnosed mental illness. I guess that's what the cynical 21st century sophisticated reader says. Oh, Mark's so naive, he didn't understand as we do about certain kinds of mental disorders. No, this is supernatural evil because this man has supernatural strength. They bind him with iron shackles and he just rips them apart. And no one can do anything about this guy. Deadly and untamable. And so all they do, I guess, is they just live with the problem. Yeah, here's a world with evil in it. None of us can do anything about it. So we just kind of get on with it. I imagine parents have told their children around the region of the Gerasenes, "Promise me you will not take the shortcut home through the graveyard, because you know that man is there. It must have been a byword in the town. But people can't deal with it. They can't do anything about it. They just have to live with it. It is a source of great fear, isn't it, to know that evil's out there and you can do nothing. And then Jesus comes along and we discover that Jesus is not scared of evil. And I love the contrast here. And we saw it last week, if you were with us. We saw Jesus in a storm, and the contrast was extreme, wasn't it? The sailors were terrified. They were all bailing out the boat. They thought they were going to drown. Meanwhile, Jesus is sleeping soundly. You know, you couldn't get more chilled out in a storm than Jesus snuggled up on a cushion in the storm. The contrast of panic and absolute control. And we get the same thing here. Here is this man with breaking the shackles, etc. But then he meets Jesus, and this just is not the closely fought battle between good and evil that you get in a horror movie. In fact, if you did have a horror movie, it would take 1 minute. It's a very, very short scene. And it begins with the demons begging Jesus not to hurt them. And it ends with Jesus giving them permission to go into the pigs. You know, please, please, please don't hurt us, don't hurt us, they say. And then in the end, Jesus just announces what they are permitted to do. Jesus is totally in control. He doesn't even have to fight for control. They recognize he's in control. And he commands their fate. And he gives them permission to go into these pigs. And the whole herd, numbering 2,000, rushed down the steep bank into the sea and were drowned into the sea. Oink, splosh, done. That is Jesus versus evil in 1 minute. It's not difficult for him. It's not a closely fought thing. He doesn't get stressed about it. He's not scared of it. There is no contest in it. Jesus is not scared of evil. And no one else can control evil, but Jesus can. Now, I need to do an aside here for the vegan audience, because we get upset for these pigs, don't we? The poor pigs. And I really don't think that's Mark's concern. He just doesn't really care about the pigs. Because here is a human being whose life is transformed. And that matters more than some pork sandwiches, sorry to say. I mean, you know, let's have good animal welfare standards. And by all means, take care of your pets and so on. But the pigs compared with the man's life is the more valuable. And I think it's here to show us what the demons were bent on doing to the man, to destroy him. And maybe there's an extra sort of Jewish commentary, because you probably know in the Old Testament, pigs were unclean animals. And so the unclean spirits go into the unclean animals and meet their ultimate end. Oink, splosh. Jesus is not scared. So here's the question. Where do you expect the story to go next? Right. So here is evil that no one can tame in the middle of a community. Terrifying evil. And then here is Jesus. And Jesus can tame it. And he does. And you'd expect, I think, celebrations, mass conversions, people turning to Jesus. Jesus, we need you. We love you. Please save us from all other evil, as you've proved that you can do now. And that is not what happens. And in fact, the next scene is actually the most chilling of all, more chilling even than a man among the tombs bent on self-destruction. This is the most chilling bit of the passage. Oh, sorry, I'm going ahead of myself. My handout is a great help, not only to you, but also to me. Sorry, let me go back, because I've missed out a point. I wanted to say Jesus' control over the evil. This brings in our first reading. Jesus' control over evil. It's just evidence of what he said in chapter 3. Let's just go there quickly before we go on. Apologies. Chapter 3, Jesus' opponents have got a problem because they're trying to argue against him, but everywhere he goes, he is doing impressive miracles. And this is a bit of a disaster for his opponents. I mean, can you imagine being on an election campaign and as you go and do a rally, your opponent starts doing huge miracles? You know, he turns up in a town and the first thing he does is empty a hospital by healing everybody. And this is it's a total nightmare for Jesus' opponents. And they can't argue Jesus isn't doing it because people see it everywhere. They see his healings and his exorcisms. So they try the only other option, which is to suggest that Jesus might have supernatural power, but it actually comes from an evil source. Jesus, they say, by the prince of demons, he casts out demons. You know, Jesus is working for the devil. And Jesus subjects that theory to a little bit of logical investigation and says, yeah, that does not really make a lot of rational sense, does it? The devil fighting against the devil. Yeah, why would you do that? I mean, that would be, if you're a Blackadder fan, that would be the worst plan since Olaf the Hairy, king of the Vikings, accidentally ordered 2,000 battle helmets with the horns on the inside. You know, that would be a bad plan. Satan fighting Satan. I don't think so. Jesus, here's a more logical explanation. He says, verse 27, no one can enter a strong man's house and plunder his goods unless he first binds the strong man. Then he may plunder his house. So Jesus describes many things in the Bible, isn't he? He's described as a shepherd because he looks after his sheep. He's described as a lamb because he's a sacrifice on our behalf when he goes to the cross. But here, and I think it's probably one of the most unusual ones, here Jesus compares himself to a thief who is guilty of breaking and entering. But the person he robs is Satan. Jesus, when you go around the country and you see exorcisms happening and you see me driving out evil, the better explanation is that I'm the one who's come and tied up the strong man. So the devil is there in the back room. I'm gagged and bound. And Jesus is rampaging through his house, helping himself. But Jesus isn't stealing his iPads or his silver or whatever. Jesus is stealing people, rescuing people out of the devil's grip. And the devil is powerless to stop him. So Jesus says, I am the one who has the power to rescue people from evil. So I just didn't want to miss that point. I thought it was important to see that image. Jesus, vastly more powerful. So let me recap. We'll get to where we were before. I forgot about this subpoint. So we said, no one can control evil. It's untamable, except Jesus can. He is stronger than the strong man. He is the one who can deliver from evil. So you'd expect, wouldn't you? What would you expect? People would be delighted. And that is not what happens. And this is the most chilling scene. People are more scared of Jesus than they are of evil. Let's pick it up in chapter 5 at verse 14. The herdsmen fled and told it in the city and in the country. And people came to see what it was that had happened. I love that, by the way, because this shows this isn't some sort of third hand, fourth hand fairy story. You know, did you hear that bloke down there apparently knows someone who apparently did this? No, this is they hear the report and they go and check it out. And this is what's always happening in the Gospels. It's eyewitness testimony. People hear rumors they want to see for themselves. So they all show up and all the witnesses are there, all the people in the town, and they check out what's happened. And in fact, they see the man himself, verse 15. They came to Jesus and saw the demon-possessed man, the one who had had the legion, sitting there clothed and in his right mind. I love that verse. I love the extravagance of it and the unnecessary wasted words. If my English teacher had marked an essay in which I had said verse 15, she would have circled it and said, this is unnecessary repetition. Just look at verse 15. They came to Jesus and saw the demon-possessed man, the one who had had the legion. It's like, well, yeah, like who else? Like there's only one demon-possessed man in this story, Mark. We haven't forgotten who it was. It was only three verses ago, right? But it's like he recaps the whole thing because he's anticipating that maybe you can't quite believe the transformation. You know, he saw the demon-possessed man. Yeah, that one. Yeah, the one with the legion. Yes, him. Sitting there, clothed, looking perfectly normal. And in his right mind, looking as normal as Philip Miles does on my screen. You know, it's just smartly dressed, smiling, everything's fine. And they see normality where there had been terrible evil. And they are afraid. It's reminiscent, isn't it, of last week. They're more afraid when everything's okay than when everything was wrong. So in the storm, when it was looking like everyone was going to meet their end, when the waves were raging, they were scared. But when it was absolutely calm, when Jesus had calmed the storm, people were more afraid. It's the same thing here. When a man lives in your graveyard, he can rip apart steel shackles, iron shackles. I mean, you know, it's just normal. We just live with it. But when the man is okay, then they're afraid. But this is not the fear swap that we saw last week, some of us. We saw last week that it's a good thing to replace our fear of death and evil with the fear of Jesus. To have Jesus as the biggest thing in our mind. That's a good thing. Fearing Jesus is a good thing. Except here, it's the same kind of idea, but it's gone sour. That they're more afraid of Jesus than of evil. But then they say, and so Jesus, please leave. Please would you get out of our country? And that is very chilling. Let me spell it out. What it's saying is that given the choice between living with evil and living with Jesus, they would prefer evil. Which is just astonishing, isn't it? Jesus, I mean, yeah, the guy was scary, Jesus. I mean, we could, you know, the fact that he would shriek out and he would smash himself with stones. I mean, it was uncomfortable. We get that, Jesus. But, you know, we kind of got used to it. We kind of handle it. But the kind of power that you're bringing in, it just really unsettles us, Jesus. And we just prefer if you would just get out of the way and just leave us be. I mean, what is going on here? It just seems such a strange scenario. And I was trying to think of an analogy for it. I think it's a bit like when you have a suspected medical problem. And you're just too scared to go to the doctor because of what it might mean. So you convince yourself it's fine. Well, I'd rather not get it seen to just in case. I mean, it's totally irrational because if it is a serious medical problem, you need it seen to. But there's that kind of weird refuge that we take in pretending we're fine rather than really facing up to things. Or if that analogy doesn't work for you with the doctor, it will certainly work for you if I say, what about the dentist? Because we've all done that, haven't we? Sorry, Graham and Claire, our resident dentist, but we've all thought it will go away, and it never goes away. You know, the toothache always gets worse, and they always say you have to go to the dentist, which in the end you do, and it costs more and so on. But I understand that procrastination. I'd rather not deal with it because I can kind of live with it. I can kind of pretend to myself it's okay, rather than the fear of getting it dealt with and dentist drills and that kind of thing. We kind of get it with the dentist, but it's more chilling, isn't it, when it's a moral thing. Jeez, I'm more comfortable living with evil than getting it sorted out. But of course that is true of us in our sin. We cling on to it. We fear Jesus interfering in it. And so people say, Jesus, just leave me alone. I'm not saying my life's okay. I mean, I admit there's stuff that's really badly wrong in it. But I can get on with that. I've kind of made my peace with that. I don't really want you interfering. Please would you leave, they say. I've been reading this book. I mentioned it last week, Rejoice and Tremble by Mike Reeves. And it's an excellent book. I've really enjoyed it. The Surprising Good News of the Fear of the Lord is the subtitle. And he's saying how, as we saw last week, fearing Jesus is really good. But then he has one chapter on sinful fear, which is where the fear of Jesus goes a bit wrong and drives us away from Jesus. And I attempted a quote this morning that I didn't think worked very well, so I'm going to do a different quote this afternoon. So here is a quote from C.S. Lewis, and it's from his book, The Great Divorce, when people from hell get a taste of what it might be like to be in heaven, and they don't like it. So a bus comes from hell, and if you know the story, and they have a go looking around heaven. And it's, let me read you a couple of scenes. This is from C.S. Lewis. It's not really from him. This book is actually from C.S. Lewis, but he is quoting C.S. Lewis. And it's an opportunity for me to plug this book as well. So Rejoice and Tremble, quoting The Great Divorce. Go away, squealed the ghost. Go away. Can't you see I want to be alone? But you need help, said the solid one. If you have the least trace of decent feeling left, said the ghost, you'll keep away. I don't want help. I want to be left alone. And then a bit later, perhaps the most poignant scene is one where we see a ghost with a cruel and whispering lizard of lust on his shoulder. An angel offers to kill the lizard and so free the ghost, at which the ghost cries, get back! You're burning me! How can I tell you to kill it? You'd kill me if you did. Oh, I know, you think I'm a coward, but it isn't that, really it isn't. Let me run back to tonight's bus, I'll be back to hell, and get an opinion from my own doctor, and I'll come back the first moment I can. It's very perceptive, isn't it, that we're just comfortable in our sin, and we fear what kind of turmoil Jesus might bring if he was allowed in. So there's areas of our life that we try to keep him out from. There's peace we sometimes make with evil because we're actually more scared of Jesus. You know, it might require dental surgery. It might require moral surgery. We're scared of what that might mean. And in the case of these townspeople, it keeps him away from Jesus altogether. That is a tragedy, isn't it? And it's a tragedy in our society. People know there is evil. You know, a city where women can't walk home safely at night. That is evil. People know that. People are scared by that. And here is Jesus with the power to deal with it. And people say, no thanks, Jesus. No, don't come near me, Jesus. I mean, that's troubling. But it's not the end of the story, because there is a happy ending, happily. And I've put rather cryptically as our heading, the third beggar. And I wonder if you can spot him. There's actually three people in the story who beg. So the first one is the demons begging Jesus to be allowed into the pigs. The second is the townspeople who beg Jesus to depart. But then verse 18, as Jesus was getting into the boat, the man who'd been possessed with demons begged him that he might be with him. I love that, because this guy says to Jesus, Jesus, you've changed my life. I was in the grip of evil and it was going to destroy me. And then one day you came along and everything has changed. And I love you, Jesus. And can I stick with you, please? Do you mind if I just tag along? I'd like to stay close to you, please. I mean, it makes sense, doesn't it? Because Jesus has transformed his life. And I guess every Christian knows this experience. Jesus, left to myself, I was headed for death and destruction. I was in the grip of evil, too powerful for me to break free from myself. And then you came along and you saved me. And I love you and I want to stay with you. Can I stay around, please? And it's rather lovely. And Jesus says no, he doesn't give him permission, but not because Jesus doesn't want him to be close to him, but because he's got a job for him to do. Verse 19, go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you. And he went away and began to proclaim in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him. And everyone marvelled. And we need this, don't we? Because there are people in London and in our, wherever we're tuning in from, in Washington, D.C., and wherever we're gathered now online for, there's people there who genuinely think they would be safer with evil than with Jesus. They really think that. And they think that Jesus, who could save them from evil, is actually bad. And the only hope really is this testimony, the opposite testimony. No, Jesus is good. He's really good. Let me tell you what he's done for me, how much he's done for me, how the Lord has had mercy on me. And this man has a job to do. He's got to tell people. Otherwise, they're going to keep saying, Jesus, stay away, stay away. I don't want you to wreck my life. And the man will say, no, he didn't wreck my life. Let me tell you, he transformed my life. And the man goes and tells how much Jesus had done for it. And everyone was amazed. I was talking to Andrew Latimer about this. And he mentioned that in the book of Acts, in chapter 8 of Acts, the gospel finally crosses the frontier into Judea and Samaria, these sort of non-Jewish territories. And when the gospel breaks into Judea and Samaria, there's a huge revival. And Andrew is just speculating that there's quite a lot of groundwork that was done there in those regions. And there's this episode, there's another episode in John's Gospel, where even though Jesus spent most of his ministry in Israel, just occasionally he crossed over to the other side of the lake. And over on the other side, he did some amazing things and they got told about. So this man starts telling people, the woman in John chapter 4 starts telling people. And so when the gospel is finally preached there after Jesus' death and resurrection, people are ready to hear it because, well, maybe because they've heard about this guy. They've heard the testimony of a man who was once in the grip of evil, telling people, let me tell you, he's good. He saved me. So we don't need to fear evil if we fear Jesus. Jesus is more frightening than evil. And Jesus has a power that makes us a bit uncomfortable. There's areas of our life that we might be tempted to keep Jesus out of because he's so frightening. But this man's got it right. Do not fear evil. Do fear Jesus. But want to be close to Jesus. Want to tell others about Jesus. Want to proclaim how much Jesus has done for us. And we're going to take a pause and then we're going to pray together.